He is married to his first wife, Anne, and they have been married for just over 25 years now, if my mathematics was correct. They have two children, a daughter, Christy Ann, who is 23 or thereabouts, and a son, David Benjamin, who is 20 years old. North Carolinian, what more can one say than that? That's God's country there, and it is good to actually have someone from North Carolina. He mentioned Asheboro. I grew up on Asheboro Street in Greensboro, which no longer exists, but was one of those streets there. Main thing, in addition to what's been said, that I want to emphasize to you is the new book that has come out. That's a part of what brought us to ask Dr. Witherington to be here today. We knew that the Old Testament colloquium was discussing archaeology and archaeological matters. When the James Ossuary came to Toronto last November, we thought that with Dr. Witherington so close by, it would be an ideal time to have him come and talk some about the James Ossuary with us. Tonight, the public lecture will be in this place. It will be at 7 o'clock, 7 to 8, and it will focus on the James Ossuary. We'll probably spend a little bit of time talking about that during the panel discussion. This is the new book that is out, that's published by Harper San Francisco, entitled The Brother of Jesus, co-written by Herschel Shanks of Biblical Archaeology Society, doing some of the archaeology aspect of it, the discovery, recounting some of that material, and then Dr. Witherington dealing with the brother of Jesus aspect, James, how James appears in the New Testament in particular. There are copies of this in the bookstore. Hint, hint, go to the bookstore. There is a book signing at 3 o'clock, I believe, in the bookstore. There will be plenty of copies, so buy four or five of them at least to help and support this enterprise on it. Dr. Witherington, I think that's enough said on it. Come and lead us a little bit in this discussion of the top 10 biblical archaeological discoveries.
All I want to do here at the outset is just give you a little context, and then we'll have our panel discussion. You need to understand that the age of archaeology, scientific archaeology, is actually it's a modern phenomenon, okay? Really, since about the middle of the 19th century, if we're talking about using modern scientific methods to study ancient sites. And New Testament archaeology has sort of been the stepchild of archaeology. It really has not gotten the attention that ancient Near Eastern and Old Testament archaeology has gotten, not really until the 20th century. So what I've done is I've sort of backed up and just summarized for you the top 10 archaeological discoveries that have some possible implication for the New Testament. And I use the word archaeology loosely because I'm also going to be talking about literary texts as well. So I go all the way back to 1850, and the first thing to be said is that it's not an accident that there was a rebirth in the study of the Shroud of Turin after the invention of modern cameras and photography. This is when the image on the shroud was first photographed by Segundo Pio, and when he was developing the negatives, saw a positive image of a person on the shroud, and this sparked an enormous amount of interest in the possibility that this was actually the shroud of Jesus. And it was one of the subtle things, at least in Europe, that set into motion a seriousness about studying the New Testament in light of archaeological evidence. Now, beginning near the end of the 19th century, we begin to have this period of archaeological digging and unearthing some 4,000 or so manuscripts or fragments of manuscripts of parts of the New Testament. And that process is just accelerated with the Nag Hammadi finds and the Dead Sea finds. But we are in a position today, in 2003, that people in 1900 were not in at all in terms of the wealth of papyrus and minuscule and majuscule and full manuscripts of the New Testament. We're in a remarkable period of finding materials that have bearing on the New Testament. In 1946, at the dawn of when Israel really was becoming a nation, we start having this accelerated excavation and study of the Holy Land from an archaeological point of view. And one of the first things that came to light of real significance was the Bedouins finding some scrolls in the caves near the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea. And they first came to light through antiquities dealers in Jerusalem. They were not provenanced finds in the first instance. They were found very much like the James ossuary and were bought off the antiquities market. I'll tell you just one little interesting footnote. There was a Franciscan friar who bought from a Bedouin a very significant scroll, one of the early scrolls that were found. And through strategic negotiating with the Israeli authorities, he got quite a lot of money for it and retired to Hackensack, New Jersey. So this sort of thing has been kind of going on for some period of time. In 1962, there was an inscription found at Caesarea Maritima, Caesarea by the Sea, Herod's great port, mentioning the prefect Pontius Pilate, and that was in 1962. Then the real period of the excavation of Capernaum, really began in 1968, and it went on for at least 30 years. There's still some more things to be done there. The so-called House of Peter was found in 1906, but it really wasn't properly excavated until 1968 to 1998. This is now underneath the Franciscan church that's there at the site, and it's under the care of the Franciscans. We know this to be a very ancient site of Christian worship from the graffito on the walls and some of the other symbolic evidence there, but according to tradition, it is in addition the House of Peter, where Jesus had his home base in Capernaum. Also in 1968, there was the skeleton of a crucified Jewish man named Yohanan. This includes, and you'll see this in many of the dictionaries of the Bible, you'll see an ossified foot through which there is this spike, and that's taken from this particular find, and it just showed, reminded us of the brutality of crucifixion. Then there's been the excavation of Masada as well as Qumran at the Dead Sea, and that's been going on for almost 50 years now in earnest, producing all kinds of interesting evidence in one way or another that at very least provides us a sort of social context and background to the New Testament, as well as helping get a feel for the earlier way of representing some portions of the Hebrew Scriptures. In the 1980s, one of the big cause celebs in terms of archaeology was the finding of this Galilean fishing boat, the so-called Boat of Jesus. No, it doesn't have carved in its stern, "Jesus slept here." But nonetheless, it's a very ancient fishing boat, and it gives you an image of what first century fishing boats likely would have looked, hand-hewn fishing boats would have looked like. Another very important dig is the excavation of Beit Shan, which still continues today. And that involves both Scythopolis, which is one of the Decapolis cities, and the Old Testament site of Beit Shan. They're right next to each other. So especially Scythopolis is of relevance for the study of the New Testament, because we hear, among other things, that Jesus went off into the Decapolis. It's the only city but west of the Jordan and the Sea of the Galilee, of the 10 cities. Then we have, in the early 1990s, the discovery of the ossuary of Caiaphas, the high priest that was presiding when Jesus was brought before the Sanhedrin shortly before his execution. Very ornate ossuary, very interesting. It has his name scrawled on the end as a kind of identity tag. And then last but not least, the discovery of the ossuary of James, the brother of Jesus, which had been extant, of course, since the biblical times, but its significance did not come to light until this past year. And we'll be talking about that tonight. Now, I just wanted to give you that brief run-up to give you a feel for some of the more significant finds, not by any means all of them, but some of the more significant finds that have a bearing on our study of the New Testament.
I'm not sure exactly how we're supposed to go from this time forward, but I guess just do some interaction here and also to have some interaction from you as well for us. One thing I'd pick up on from what you did just now with that and sort of encourage you to say another word or two about it. Much of New Testament studies, as well as Old Testament studies that I'm more involved with over the last quarter century, has been involved with literary approaches.
Right.
And literary studies, and basically so many of those using the literary approaches say it isn't necessary, and in some instances it isn't even appropriate to ask the historical questions. I don't hear you following that approach at all. Would you like to interact a little bit with that?
Well, I should first say that I'm a literature major from Carolina, mm-hmm. and so I'm all very happy with literary approaches to the New Testament, but not as a be-all and end-all. It is sometimes said in the postmodern setting that all we have is texts when it comes to antiquity. Well, I think this is nonsense because, of course, there are far more than texts than we have. We have physical artifacts like this little ossuary down here, which is not a text at all. And so we have social realia as well as other kinds of historical artifacts as well as texts. And I would say that all of it's important. All of it is necessary to the understanding of the New Testament. So I'm not... part of the problem is that New Testament studies, like almost all disciplines, have become increasingly more compartmentalized and specialized. And that's a good thing in regard to going in depth on a particular subject and running with the ball as far as you can. But it's not a good thing if you have tunnel vision and you don't have the breadth of input in regard to all of the evidence that would be of relevance to helping us understand the meaning of the biblical text. And so I'm not enamored with reader response criticism or other approaches that really want to be solipsist and sort of make everything into some form of literary criticism. I'm not happy with that at all.
Okay. Also, what about the sense in which, and I believe Bill Deaver may have been the one who worded it this way in a Biblical Archaeology Review article, that texts and artifacts both are very similar in that both require interpretation. Both, in effect, are mute in and of themselves, mere words on the one hand, a mere artifact on the other. And it's only as we interpret those that they have meaning for us.
Well, that has a lot to do with your own theory of meaning and where meaning comes from. If you believe meaning is in the eye of the beholder, then Bill Deaver is right. I don't happen to believe that. I think texts actually have meaning encoded into them by their authors, and I think it's tremendously disrespectful of the original authors and makers of texts to suggest that we have a right to tell them what they actually said or read into the text. That's eisegesis, as far as I'm concerned, rather than exegesis. And so I think a historically respectful approach to text does not say these things are mute and they have no meaning in and of themselves, and therefore we have to give it a meaning. It's just a matter of our interpretation. No, I think it's our job to discover or find out what the meaning is of these texts by diligent study of text in context. And so, I think they come laden with meaning. I don't think it's just a case of our giving meaning. Now, of course, a lot of times in our eagerness, we do read into artifacts or texts more than is there. There's no doubt about that. We do that. I had a young girl when I was in Durham come to me in a Sunday school class, and she was puzzling over the authorized version. And she said, "It says in the Psalms, God is a mighty God, an awful God is he. I didn't think he was awful. I thought he was nice." And I said, "Well, honey, it's like this. The word awful in 1611 meant full of awe and wonder, and what it means today is something very different. It actually has a meaning almost antithetical to that. Languages are living things, and therefore that's all the more reason why you need to study things in their original context, because otherwise you're going to read later meanings or later ideas into the text. And the hedge against that kind of anachronism is actually studying things in their various contexts."
Okay.
I wondered if you'd like to comment on the phenomenon of the ossuaries themselves, not so much the specific one that you're going to talk about this evening, but the sudden appearance of the ossuaries and some of the other phenomena right around the same time.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? From about 20 BC till the fall of the temple in 70 AD is the primary period, not exclusively so, but it's certainly the primary period in Jewish history when this practice of reburial or osligium comes to the fore here. It did continue for a while after 70 AD. There's evidence on into the second century, but it was no longer a sort of real popular practice after 70 AD. What is the significance of this? Well, for me, one of the interesting possibilities is that it increases with the rise of the Pharisaic movement. And what we know about first century Pharisees, or even first century BC Pharisees, is that one of their dominant theological agendas was a belief in the bodily resurrection, as opposed to the Sadducean position, which said, no, there's Sheol and there's more Sheol and that's all there is to talk about. And so I don't think it's accidental that you have the rise of prominence of the Pharisaic movement with the rise of the practice of osligium, or the reburial process. And maybe I should just describe that process. You know, I'd never really read the story of Jesus this way before I studied ossuaries. I'd never thought about, okay, this is phase one. They're laying him out in a tomb. They're just wrapping him up. They're putting spices on his body as an odor retardant. But then what they plan to do is, after the flesh is desiccated, then they're going to take the bones and put them in an ossuary. That's what would have happened to Jesus if Jesus hadn't risen from the dead. So, you know, you can go back now and read those gospel stories and say, wow, I hadn't thought about that. And that's another reason why people would be expected to regularly continue to visit the tomb, because they want to continue to be able to wrap spices in the winding wrap and be able to continue to go there time after time until desiccation has happened. So we now have this practice of reburial in a bone box. Why? Well, some of it surely goes back to the Pharisaic understanding of the Ezekiel text, you know, the famous valley of dry bones. And the sort of nodal assumption there is, well, we need to keep the bones together since the body's going to be raised from the dead, and they'll put new flesh on these old bones. So we need to keep the person intact to that degree if we can possibly manage it. And so you have infant ossuaries like this one over here. You have full adult, single adult size ossuaries. You have condo ossuaries where several people are put in one ossuary, and whole family ossuaries as well. And it's fascinating. So what you have is a practice of burial and then reburial in preparation for the resurrection. And it's not different in some regards to what you find in Jerusalem today. If you go to the Mount of Olives, to the top of the Mount of Olives, you find Orthodox rabbis buried at the top of the Mount of Olives. Why did they want to be buried there? Because they want to be first up from the dead to meet Messiah when he comes over the Mount of Olives, when he comes. So, you know, in Orthodox Judaism, which is a development of Pharisaic Judaism, we still have that spirit of belief in resurrection. And so we still have that concern about keeping the remains intact and keeping them in a particular place and that sort of thing. I think that this tells us, in regard to the James ossuary, that Jesus' family was, in that regard, Pharisaic. It believed in the resurrection. It looked forward to the sure and hope, certain hope of the future resurrection. And the earliest Jewish Christians who provided for the burial of James in Jerusalem, not in Nazareth now, in Jerusalem, were looking forward to something happening to James that already happened to his brother. And so, I mean, I think that's part of the significance of it.
How would you respond to those who argue that that the ossuaries are not, in fact, evidence of widespread Pharisaic influence, but simply reflect the rise in the stone-cutting industry and this sort of thing, or who suggest that because you have family bone boxes that the thought of the resurrection is to be discounted and that sort of thing?
Well, I would say to that that most of those who are, there's a professor in England, John Kane, who did a major dissertation on ossuaries. Very fascinating. He's very old school. He's one of those that looks at every single ossuary on the planet doing his dissertation, as well as Rachmani's whole catalog of ossuary inscriptions, and then does sort of the exhaustive and exhausting study on the matter. And one of the things that's very clear from his study, Richard Bauckham thankfully put me on to this, is that wherever you find ossuaries, you find some kind of belief in an afterlife. It may not be the full resurrection form, but you have some kind of belief in the afterlife. I've been very impressed with Richard Bauckham's extensive study called The Fate of the Dead, which really chronicles this growing, burgeoning belief in the afterlife in various forms in early Judaism, one of which is the belief in bodily resurrection. So that even the Sadducees, even somebody like Caiaphas, was hoping for some kind of positive afterlife, even if he was going to be a shade like Samuel, mm-hmm. you know. And when you have that kind of viable belief in afterlife, whatever form it's going to take, then there's automatically more respect for what happens to the dead, because they're going to go on existing. I mean, that's the point. They're going to go on existing in some form, and therefore you don't want to disrespect them. That's what I would say to that.
Do you think the ossuaries could also be some evidence of the influence of Hellenism in this period? First off, in the well, at least the measure of individualism that is expressed by having an individual bone box, but then also in the rosettes. Apparently, these were the same sorts of emblems that you would have on pillars and columns that come from the Herodian period, mm-hmm. and so could be a sign of the assimilation of Hellenistic culture.
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you see this, Caiaphas's ossuary has got these beautiful big rosettes, and it's very ornate, far more ornate than the James box. It does have two rosettes on the backside, very faint. I think that's right. You know, it's one of those negotiated kind of things. How much Hellenism is too much Hellenism? Do we still have enough Jewish antibodies? So we're not, for example, going to do what the Egyptian culture did, was put an image of the deceased, paint an image of the deceased on the lid of the coffin, so to speak. No, we're going to go with floral designs, not iconic sort of designs, but floral designs. But we like the floral designs that we picked up from Hellenism. So, yeah, it certainly does attest to a measure of Hellenization of Judaism. And since people were buying these boxes preformed, it'd be hard to know how much you could deduce about the Hellenization of the owner of the ossuary or the recipient, the person who's buried in the ossuary. It may say more about the stone cutter than it says about the family who bought this, because they had to buy what was on the market. It wasn't like going to Walmart and saying, okay, we got 73 ossuaries here, which one are we going to pick, you know? So they had what they had to choose from.
One last one. If, in fact, the ossuaries do attest to the widespread influence of the Pharisees in the New Testament era, in the time when Jesus walked the earth, does that tell us about... obviously, the Gospels presuppose that the Pharisees had wide influence, but
right.
This is a time when people are, so to speak, actually quite pious. There's a later expression from one of the Tanaitic rabbis that in this time purity broke forth in Israel. How should that shape our view of, say, John the Baptist's message or Jesus' message in such a context? How might that help us understand the Gospels better?
Well, I think we have various of what, you know, if I can use a Wesleyan expression, of what I would call holiness movements in early Judaism. The Pharisaic movement was a holiness movement. The Dead Sea sect was another kind of holiness movement. John the Baptist, who may or may not have had some connection with the Dead Sea sect, it was a calling to holiness. And then you have the Jesus movement, which is yet another kind of holiness movement. They're all manifesting this deep sense that something is really rotten in Denmark. You know, something is really wrong in Israel. And that there needs to be revival and reform and renewal. I mean, and more so than, say, you know, when we get anxiety about the spiritual state of America and sort of go, oh, we need more revivals. No, I think it's a much more profound thing, because Israel is an occupied land, and especially Judea, that's especially obvious, you know. And so there's this deep anxiety about what have we done wrong? How do we need to repent? Where do we go from here? What does it mean to be a Jew? You know, I think all of that is in play in Jesus' era. And it's a volatile thing, because, of course, when you're trying to save lost Israel, you know, and one trajectory is going, okay, we need to preach the gospel of Leviticus. This is the Pharisees. Everybody, we've got a priesthood of all believers, going to keep all of these purity codes. Everybody's got to keep all of these purity codes. And then maybe we'll make God an offer he can't refuse, you know. That's one kind of holiness movement, and Jesus is going in a very different direction than that. I think it does tell us about the profoundly religious nature of this culture, from stem to stern, and attempts to minimize the deeply spiritual and religious character of the culture, which happens a lot in sociological studies, is a mistake, you know. Or to treat religion like we would treat it in modern times, as a sort of a compartmentalized thing over here as opposed to politics and things like that. I think that whole culture was shot through with piety and religious concerns of various kinds, and there were a lot of forms of early Judaism, and the Jesus movement was one form.
So Jesus could in fact be said to have, and the Baptist as well, to have called people away from the sort of piety they had been come accustomed to, and it helps to explain perhaps why he found a special hearing among those who were noted for not practicing such piety.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think that John, it starts really with John the Baptist, where he's offering release from sins by just coming to him and being baptized. Now, you don't have to go all the way to the temple. You don't have to offer this sacrifice of atonement or that sacrifice or the other sacrifice or way of offering or whatever. And boy, this is radical. This is the shortcut method. Don't have to leave Galilee to get there from here. You know, you just go down to the Jordan. And the Jesus movement, to some extent, grows out of John's movement. And the same sort of thing is going on. Jesus is going to be pretty temple critical, as Mark 13 makes clear. He's not just concerned with the temple being unclean. He actually forecasts the destruction of this particular temple apparatus, the Herodian temple. And so, yes, I think you're right. I think he's doing a new and different thing. But at the same time, I mean, I'm struck by the fact that whoever the folks were living at the Qumran community, whether they were Essenes or not, and I think they probably were, well, they also didn't apparently think that they needed to go to Jerusalem to accomplish their transactions with God. And therefore, Jesus was part of a stream of critique, if you will, in early Judaism that would have disagreed with the Sadducees and their vested interest in the current temple cultus, and would have disagreed with the Pharisees. Now, I'm not in agreement with a lot of things that Ed Sanders says about the Pharisaic movement, or Jacob Neusner, for that matter, either. I think we can know a lot more about the Pharisaic movement from the New Testament than they would allow. But what I am pretty convinced of from Tony Saldarini's work and others is that the Pharisees were based in Jerusalem. And that was sort of their central locus. And then they had sort of forays into Galilee in various ways. And that's fine. But Galilee was not a great haven for Pharisaic belief. So when Pharisees turn up in Galilee checking out Jesus, it's because he's a notable teacher. It's because he's really sort of stirring up the pot. And they're concerned because his answers to the solution for lost Israel are not the same as their answers, and it may even threaten the temple cultus. And my goodness, the Pharisees have finally gotten the Sadducees to do the sacrifices the way the Pharisees wanted them to do it. Now, you know, we don't want to be undercutting the temple apparatus at this time when we're trying to get the gospel of Leviticus preached all over the land. So, you know, I mean, I think there is this, these are not just ships passing in the night, these are trains on a head-on collision here. And so I think that some of the animus that you see reflected in the Gospels is not just later animus between Pharisees and Christians, but a real animus between Jesus and the Pharisaic movement.
Let me go back to the ossuary issue for a minute. In the Old Testament period, you definitely had the use of family tombs and the primary interment, and then coming back a year later approximately and gathering the bones to the ancestors, having a pit or a single spot that the bones would be gathered. Since this has a long tradition, going back at least to the 8th, 7th century B.C. with the tombs that we find there, why the sudden appearance of ossuaries 20 B.C., if that's the date that you would say, does that give evidence of association with Pharisaic belief, or just what's going on?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think also of the rise of Herod. See, you do have to, Herod was sort of a builder megalomaniac, and he is the one who gave the stonecutters sort of a lifetime job of building the Herodian temple and the accoutrements that go with that. And, you know, when they had an off day, they could make knock off a few ossuaries here, there, and yonder, you know. And so I think it's linked to the fact that we're dealing with Herod. Now, there's another little clue on the James ossuary to that effect. It has, you know, if you know about Herodian stones in the western wall of the temple, they have a rim, so what I would call a rim around. Well, this ossuary does as well. It has the Herodian rim around it. I think it's the enormous architectural and impact of the Herodian revolution, really, that's part of this deal here. I think that's partly why. Because the truth of the matter is that Herod was not, properly speaking, through putting out fires and really in power until about the 20s B.C., really. You know, that's really when he had come into his glory and began to start building campaigns and, you know, the Mercurium and some of the other Herodium and some of those other building campaigns. So, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the times. It has to do with Herod. And to me, the real icing on the cake in regard to the James ossuary is that this is very clearly Herodian Aramaic. It's a specific style of mostly cursive, but with some formal characters as well of Aramaic. And so you've got two features on this ossuary that point towards Herod. You've got the rim, and you've got the way the Herodian Aramaic script is written. You know, and it's very telling. It means it's a pre-70 AD thing.
Would you want to comment on the stone jars and Volantinus's work on the stone vessels, stone jars that pop up at the same time?
Well, you know, I haven't done a lot of reflection on those, but the one story in the Gospels that's made me wonder about is the story of the wedding feast at Cana,
right?
Jewish purification jars, you know, and I'm going, okay, what can we learn from this? Is this, I mean, why would you have at a normal Jewish home in a village these huge vats for not just ordinary water, not just retaining, not just cisterns. We're talking jars for purification water. Why? Well, again, I mean, I think it's these converging lines of evidence with the influence of the concerns for ritual purity from the Pharisees and some of these other developments sort of coming together and overlapping. Professor Tate has a question. Okay. Right. The question is about the cleansing of the temple. It's my view that what Jesus does in the temple is a prophetic sign act. And so I don't think it's actually helpful to call it the cleansing of the temple, because if that's what it was intended to do, it was singularly ineffective. It cleansed 1.3 centimeters of the temple and left the rest as it was. So I would take this as a prophetic sign act, and what I take it as a sign act is, A, on the one hand, it's a critique of the things, some of the things that are going on in the temple that Jesus thinks is anathema. We know for a fact that sacrificial animals could be bought on the Mount of Olives, and didn't need to be sold in the temple precincts at all. So I think that's one of the things that's irking him about that, especially in the temple, in the court of the Gentiles. Because, I mean, you've got a barnyard where people are supposed to be able to pray or worship God, and the court of Gentiles is the only place Gentiles could come and do that in the temple. So I think that's, he is concerned about that kind of pollution or interference there. And then, of course, there's also the whole business about the priests making money off the exchange of money in the temple as well. Now, who's selling the animals and making money off of that? The priests and the Levites are. Who's making money off the exchange of money? Well, it's not Thomas Cook. It's the priests and the Levites, And so there is at least an implicit critique of the temple hierarchy in what Jesus did. But more than that, I would want to compare that action with what he says in Mark 13, which is that he believes that this temple is doomed. It's the temple of doom. He believes that it's going to be destroyed. He prophesies its destruction, and I think the prophetic sign act is a way of symbolically representing that this thing's going to be turned upside down. So I think it sort of has two functions. So it's not just about, I would like to see this purified, because in Jesus' view, that's not a radical enough critique. And if we actually read the somewhat obscure reports of what Jesus is accused of at the trial, in several ways it has to do with he's talking about the destruction of the temple. He's talking about the destruction of the temple. I think that's actually not an entirely false accusation, because he did talk about the destruction of the temple. No, I don't think that's the case. I've read this about, if you interfere with people crossing the court, then you slowed down progress in regard to the daily sacrifice and that sort of stuff. I find that explanation less convincing than what I've just said. It's not impossible. Maybe he had a multi-pronged attack on the temple cultists. I don't know. But that one doesn't strike as, if he had instructed the disciples to go out two by two into the temple courts and just dramatically interrupt everything the best they could, then maybe. But I don't really see that in what he does.
We'll open it up for other questions or such that you might have. Yes, Jim. I was going to say, come to a microphone, if you would, please.
I know, Dr. Drinkard, that in seminar you've been alluding to the fact that the James Ossuary could be a replica or a fake of some kind. Excuse me. And I was just wondering if you could state your points as to why you thought it was a replica, and then if Dr. Witherington would respond to that.
Seminars you've been in, but you've not heard me call it a replica or a fake.
Well,
there. what you have.
You've had questions
me.
In your mind.
I'll be glad to clarify that. No,
he's trying to get you in my water here.
By the way, you can forget about taking comps this spring. What I have said is that I am convinced that it is a genuine first-century ossuary. I have no question at all about that. I also think it's the strongest likelihood that the inscription itself on it is an authentic inscription. I do recognize authentic and ancient both as well, that it's not a forgery. I do know that there are some like Kyle McCarter who say the inscription may be by two separate hands, that the latter part of the inscription, which says the brother of Jesus, that may have been by a second hand, because those are the characters that seem to be less formal Aramaic characters for those. So I'm aware of that. What I have said, though, is I'm not convinced that that's necessarily our James, our Jesus, that's referred to on it. That's the part that I am saying I'm less convinced 100%. But as far as the ossuary being an authentic ossuary, absolutely. The inscription, I do not think, is a modern forgery at all. I think it is an ancient inscription. Whether it's by two hands, I'm not enough of an expert in Aramaic to know that one way or another. I certainly do see a couple of the characters, the Aleph in brother of, that is very unusual, the Dalid of or which, that is a very unusual shape for it. The letters seem much sharper and crisper in the first half of the inscription. They are deeper incisions in it. That's another factor that makes me wonder a little bit. But as far as its authenticity, you just flunked that part of the comp there on it. No, it is authentic, and I think the inscription is authentic. I'm not sure that we have full enough evidence to say it is our James, our Jesus. And let me throw one other word in as to a little bit of the question of it. Part of the question that I raise is something on sociological grounds as well. I don't consider that Jesus and the Jesus family would have been a very wealthy family. And the use of ossuaries and of family tombs especially, I think, belonged more to the elite, maybe not upper class, but certainly upper middle class and such, that the common person would have had primary interment only, would not have had a family tomb, and unlikely that they'd have had secondary burial a year later, had ossuarium that they practiced. Early Christians, as I understand it, were out of favor with both the Jews by this time and by the Romans. The Jews saw them as being a heretical sect. The Romans, thinking they were just another Jewish group, which were causing trouble in that pre-70 time frame. So they're caught on by both sides. And Paul has to bring an offering because of the poor in Jerusalem to take care of some of the needs and all. So that scenario doesn't, to me, seem to fit what I would expect for family tombs and ossuaries and all. So now, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. It's 2:30 now, so as a tease, I could say, come tonight, and you will hear all the answers to these questions, but I won't just do that.
Them come back. That's a good idea.
That's the idea. What I will say is there are answers to these are legitimate concerns that he has about this. And so I will give you three or four telegraphic teases here, and we'll play this out later this evening. The first thing I would say is that the statistical analysis has now been done and redone about five times about the frequency of names, Yaakov, Yosef, Yeshua. And the rarest of these three names is the actual Yaakov name. It only appears in 2% of the evidence that we have, both inscriptional, papyrus, etc., etc. And more importantly, the particular form of the name Yaakov that we have here, this apocopated form, is only found in 5% of that 2%. So it's very, very rare. And Richard Baucom is now publishing an article on the ossuary with all of this detail laid out. And I think he finds it a very convincing argument that this is by no means a forgery, because a forger would have used the basic biblical form of the name, not this form. So that's point number one. I think when you run the statistics, there were possibly four or five families that might have these three names in it in Jerusalem at the time in which James died, in about AD 62. And so the actual odds of this not being who it appears to be are fairly slim, I think, especially when you realize that no other ossuaries save one ever mentioned the brother of the deceased. No other ossuaries save one. Go through the whole Rachmani catalog, go look at all the ossuaries. Only one other ossuary ever mentions a brother. And here's another interesting fact that Baucom has demonstrated. Any time you have not just the name of the person and a patronymic, i.e. so-and-so, son of so-and-so, anytime anything else is mentioned, whatever else is mentioned is mentioning somebody very important or significant that is related to or has a bearing on the deceased. Okay? So what we know for sure is that the phrase brother of Jesus is referring to somebody more significant than Yaakov. More significant than Yaakov. So that the brother of clause in this ups the ante as to who this might be. Who is a more famous Yeshua than this particular Yaakov in this particular case? The physical surface of the box, first of all, this is pretty lousy limestone. It's Jerusalem limestone, and the left end of the inscription is on a very porous piece of limestone. So I don't even think it was physically possible to carve the letters as deeply as they did in the right-hand side of the inscription. If you actually examine it, both sides of the box and into the box, there are all these little pock marks and porous holes in the left-hand side where the inscription is. It's not an accident that the thing broke where it broke, which is right over the last two words there. So I think that accounts some for the difference. The other thing is that Oded Golan's mom cleaned the first couple of words on this with Windex or whatever she used, you know, some kind of cleaning. This is why we actually have more patina, the film, on the left-hand side of the inscription than the right-hand side, and perhaps someday we'll clean the whole thing and it'll all look fairly much the same. But in regard to the Aramaic script, in terms of it being two hands, I mean, I think that's been pretty much ruled out. What we know about Herodian Aramaic is that it has a collection of both formal and informal features when it's written, especially when you realize that stone carvers of ossuaries were not mainly doing this for a living. You know, this is just something done either by a member of the family. These were not professional calligraphers or stone carvers. They were just doing it because somebody asked them to put this on the box. And therefore, it's unlikely that we would expect all formal features. It's no different than us. When I write my name, some of the characters are cursive and some are not. No big deal. But the truth of the matter is that in the last two words, we have both letters that are formal and we have letters that are informal. And the truth of the matter is that when you compare the formal letters that are identical in the last part of the inscription with the ones in the first, they look very much the same, like the ayin. The ayin is very close. So if we had formal characters in the first half of the inscription that looked radically different than in the last